every type of criminal investigation is specific. You don't investigate the theft of a Chevrolet the same way you would investigate the theft of a Monet. It's two different things. So to some degree, yeah. I mean, yeah, your forensics are the same when it comes to fingerprinting. Forensics are the same when it comes to, say, bullets and rounds coming out of barrels of guns and all that type of thing. Those aren't going to change, but the players are going to change, and the attitudes change very dramatically.
Well, how would you be alerted if say, a museum comes in at 10 in the morning on Monday and they see that something is off the wall? Would the FBI get the call soon after?
Well, I would hope. I would hope they would do that. What I would say as far as advice is concerned, would be to immediately call your local police, all right off the bat, because you don't know if the perpetrators are still in the museum or not. They could be hiding in there, and it could be a dangerous situation for people. So I would say call the police right away, 911, and then after that's been done, then call the FBI as far as the investigation is concerned, because theft from a museum is now a federal crime. So anyone who steals items from a museum that reach certain values and certain ages are committing actually a federal crime that can be investigated by the FBI and the federal government.
Would you work on more than one case at a time?
Yeah, I did. I worked on many cases at a time. I would be on four or five different cases working different places. I was undercover probably from 1997 straight through to 2008 when I retired. So for about 11 years, I was working somewhere in the world. And I had worked in 22 different countries. So somewhere in the world, I was undercover all the time.
Well, the art world is an insular world, I would think, a small world. Wouldn't you have to guard against earning a rep as the guy who's always looking for for stolen art?
Well, you know, you say the art world is a small world, but, you know, it's a $200 billion industry worldwide. When we start looking at some of these facts, it's not such a small world. It's $200 billion worldwide throughout the whole world. And then, of course, the United States, we are the largest consumer of art. More than 40% of the whole art world budget is in the United States. So it's a huge industry, in fact. It's many times larger than both the NFL and the Major League Baseball put together. So, you know, it's not that small a world, quite honestly. And there are so many different facets, and I like to call them like tributaries in a river. I mean, every different tributary is a different type of art, whether it's, Impressionist paintings or pre-Columbian artifacts or Native American artifacts. They're all different. And many times the players in each of the different types of games don't play together, you know. It's all different types of art and different types of players.
You're talking about expensive works of art. And so you're talking about people who potentially, if caught, could spend a long time, if not the rest of their life, in jail. You're talking about people who would try to make a lot of money, perhaps, off stolen art. This could be a dangerous endeavor, you trying to find out who has stolen something or where it is.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, it's the same as any other criminal activity. What's interesting is that, you know, what we found out throughout the years is that the people who are doing these art heists, these armed robberies of museums and whatnot, say in France and in Sweden and different places, and here in the U.S. as well, they're into all kinds of different criminal activities. I mean, the art heist is one type, but they're also involved in, you know, stolen cars, drug running, weapons running. So, you know, when they go in and they do an armed robbery of a museum, it's just as if they're doing an armed robbery of a bank or anywhere else. So, yeah, they're dangerous individuals who are criminals and who make their living by doing that.
Are most art thefts face-to-face sort of armed robbery?
Well, not so much in the U.S., but in Europe, there's quite a few. There's probably been a good dozen large armed heists in the past 7 or 8 years. Just recently in France, there was one in Nice where individuals went in with machine guns and stole four paintings. Another activity occurred in May in Paris, where a guy went in the middle of the night and stole five paintings from the Paris Museum of Modern Art worth more than $100 million. So these heists are very, very high profile and high valued.
Hollywood and fiction often likes to portray the art thief as a cunning rogue and perhaps a lawbreaker, but someone who often in films we identify with or we're rooting for. Did that ever bother you?
Well, it doesn't bother me. I mean, you know, there is a mystique to art theft. And I do talk about that in the talks I will be doing this afternoon at the school. It's an interesting story. Hollywood likes to portray things in a certain way. You know, there are individuals out there who have committed these heists who are not, you know, who are not your average criminal. Some of them are experts, you know, and do know what they're doing, talking about when they're in the field. And at some point, they gain enough knowledge that they're able to have access to collections that most people don't have access to. And at that point, they start to you know, feel like they are privileged and should have the items. So, and we've seen that a few times. And I talk about that in the book in Priceless.
If when something is stolen, like Rembrandt's self-portrait, worth more than $35, $36 million, and in the art world is well known, why is it being stolen? And you can't put that up in your living room.
That's right. Well, you know, Kyle, what I say is that the true art in an art heist is not the stealing, it's the selling. And what happens is that, you know, when these guys steal these pieces, they try to put them on the market. And that's when we recover them, whether it's through an undercover police operation or if it comes back to market to be sold at an auction or if someone dies and it's still in an estate, that's when we get them back. So, yeah, you know, many times these guys are great criminals, but they're terrible businessmen. And they don't realize that what they're taking is really a white elephant that they're stuck with.
Yeah, I remember when the Scream, when one of the versions of the Scream was taken. And the question was, what could you do with that?
Well, let me answer that question very quickly. In Europe, oftentimes they steal these items. The first idea is to sell them somehow, all right, to get rid of them in some way and make money. Once they find out that they can't do that, and many conversations I've had in criminal circles, you know, as while working undercover in Europe, what they do is they stockpile the paintings, and then when they get caught for doing something else, you know, whether it's a car theft or a robbery of a bank or something of that nature, they try to make a deal, and they try to use a, you know, as a bargaining chip, the paintings, to try to get their sentences reduced.
You worked undercover, so you had to be working with some unsavory characters.
Quite oftentimes, that's correct.
You know, I can't help but go back to Dashiell Hammett and the Maltese Falcon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and thinking,
great movie.
Yeah, and Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet and these people that wanted this, an artifact, a piece of art,
right,
and were willing to do almost anything to get it. Is that anything like what you had to experience?
Well, the individuals that I dealt with mostly were interested in the money, not so much in achieving the art. They were more interested in achieving the art to sell it, to make money. So that's the level, you know, where you go in and try to stop the thefts and recover the artworks. Generally, once it's reached a point, if it reaches a point, and I'm not saying that it does that often, because I've never actually seen that situation. I call it the Dr. No syndrome, where, you know, you have this rich guy who lives in a cave and hides his paintings. I've never actually seen that in 20 years of investigations. You know, I think that once it reaches that point, you have to wait till that person either passes away or somebody discovers it by chance, you know. So you want to try to get art back before it reaches that that final stage, if it ever gets there. Most of what I've seen is criminals who steal the art, who attempt to try to sell it and have it for a few years, and then finally they make a mistake and they fall into the hands of the police.
If you work undercover, you have to create lies, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is that ever difficult, keeping them straight?
Well, you know, you have to, well, there's certain tricks to the trade. We can talk about that. I'll be talking about that maybe a little bit at the speech or the talk, the presentation. So, yeah, there are tricks to that trade, and there's ways of keeping things straight that we use. And, you know, I'm not giving out any secrets. These are things that are pretty
right.
well known. But, yeah, there are tricks to that. And you do want to try to keep that separate because and what I would do is I would use different backstories and whatnot for different cases so I knew which case I was talking about when I was on the phone talking to people.
One of the items you helped recover was an original copy of the Bill of Rights. Is that correct?
That was a great case back in 2003, in fact. It was gone for almost 165 years. It was actually stolen by a Union trooper during the Civil War. It was on his march back from Atlanta, and he was coming back north, and as they went through North Carolina, they stopped at Raleigh. They took the state, and they went into the state house, and this one Union trooper from Indiana basically scooped it up and took it with him.
So it was, in the art theft world, it was a cold case, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a pretty cold case. 165 years, a long time. Things get cold after that much time.
So is it an active investigation, or is it something that through other investigations you kind of...
Well, no, what happened was it was offered for sale. Oh. Remember I told you that many times these things come back to market, and that's when we retrieve them. was offered for sale to the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia for $4 million. And, you know, we got a call, the FBI got a call from the Constitution Center saying, you know, this is being offered to us, this is legitimate. And, you know, at that point we set up an undercover sting operation where we were able to recover it after we identified it as the copy that was sent to North Carolina for ratification by George Washington in 1789.
Since the days of John Dillinger and J. Edgar Hoover, there have been the 10 most wanted fugitives. Is there such a thing in the art theft?
There is. Well, what happened was in 2005, I was instrumental in the creation of the National FBI Art Crime Team. And when we did that, we trained agents from around the country to be investigators for art, you know, in art theft circles. So at the same time, what we did, we created a new top 10 most wanted FBI art crimes. And we do have a list of the 10 pieces around the world that we want to try to get back. It's not a numerical order. In other words, number one is not more important than number 10. It is just 10. And if you go to the FBI, I think the FBI.gov art crime site, you can actually see a listing of them.
One last question. Do you own art?
Do I own art? I have some pieces, yeah. I do collect some fine art prints. My parents were in the antiques business, so when my dad passed away, he was in the Asian antiques business. I have a lot of Asian pieces. And, yeah, I do collect a little bit.
Well, very good.
I got a good security system.
I bet you do. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, sir.